49, northeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, sunset 5:48, partly cloudy and cool, a low of 33. Thursday, cloudy and 49. Right now, cloud cover, wind north at 14, 41 degrees Kenosha, 40 in Racine. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Bird is next.
For anybody who appreciates the gift of good food, and especially the notion of comfort food, especially in these winter months, you might really appreciate a book called Cherries in Winter, My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. This isn't so much a book about food in the midst of the cold temperatures of winter, as much as it is about food being one of the things to which we turn when times are tough. And when we need to feel better about ourselves and about our lives. That certainly was the experience, continues to be the experience of writer Suzanne Colon, who found herself in a very hard place, which is an all too familiar place right now, that is unemployed, laid off from a job that she absolutely loved, writing for a magazine. And one of the things that this meant for her, the reality of a much tighter budget for herself and her husband, was that she needed to get back in the kitchen and do more cooking from scratch. And that meant turning to some of the recipes of her grandmother. And somehow in that experience, she found herself also being in a new sort of connection with her grandmother. And with the long history in her family of struggles with money and of tough times and of hanging on and holding together and somehow soldiering through periods of difficulty. And even in those periods of feeling broke, not being poor. And it has inspired her to write a really wonderful memoir, which also has a few recipes sprinkled in. The book is called Cherries in Winter, My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. It's published by Doubleday, a beautifully written book, and I'm very happy that I have Suzanne Colon with me. She is a contributing writer and editor for O, the Oprah magazine. Her writing has appeared in all kinds of different places, including Harper's Bazaar and Rolling Stone. And we have her on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about Cherries in Winter. Suzanne Colon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
I look forward to this very, very much. I always wonder what it's like for a writer to go through life experiencing some of the things that the rest of us experience. And for us, they tend to be just the experiences themselves. And for a writer, they are whatever you're experiencing and also potential fodder for your vocation, if you know what I mean. I mean that when you suffer a great success or a terrible loss or whatever, it's also something that you might choose to write about. I wonder if you have any sense of how that changes the way in which you sort of live your life and experience these things, good and bad.
It does change things. Actually, that's a very good point that you've made, because my job is not really to talk about myself. My job is, I'm sort of a storyteller. You know, that seems to be my assignment in life, if you will. Not something that I chose, but that chose me. And I've always said about this book in particular, Cherries in Winter, that this is not the story of my family. It's the story of all of our families, because when I started telling the stories of my Nana working during the Great Depression when she was 16 years old and getting by on a corn muffin, you know, split between breakfast and lunch and a can of soup for dinner, and hardships like that, that really gave me a wonderful perspective check about what I was going through during the recession. What those stories did was they triggered other people's memories of their family hardships and the strength and resilience that their family members had shown to get through those very challenging times. You know, some were Holocaust survivors. Others had been through world wars, just like my family. And others had just been through, you know, the rigors of life and gotten through it with good cheer and more backbone than they started out with. And so as a writer or as a storyteller or whatever it is that I am, I'm conveying universal themes, especially in this book right now. This is something that is not, I don't approach it from an egotistical standpoint at all. When I'm writing about myself, I'm thinking, what is the reader getting out of this? This is not about me, me, me. It's about us. And so I'm always thinking about the person reading it. How are they relating to this? And what universal themes can I strike that will bring a resonance to this story?
It's interesting you should say that, because this book feels like it's absolutely true. I mean, it does not. This feels like you are telling very real stories about very real people. It does not seem doctored, and yet what you just said about being concerned about the reader and wanting to deliver helpful messages and to connect with them, that probably underscores what is tempting for some people who write memoirs, which is to doctor what occurred to make it even more inspirational or even more amazing or striking and so on. And my sense is that you haven't done that here, but does one have that temptation when you're writing about your own life?
No, not really, because I just, you know, that would infer sort of setting me apart from the rest of the human experience, and I don't feel any different than the next person. I was very humbled in a good way, I think, by being laid off last year. Excuse me. I felt, you know, I was a number. You know, I was a statistic. I was an early adopter, an unwilling one, yes, but an early adopter of this massive layoff that occurred during 2008 and unfortunately is still occurring as we end 2009. And, you know, I kept thinking, gosh, I wish there were something that I could read that would make me feel better, because it was just such a scary time for all of us. You know, this when the banks were failing and people were, you know, being evicted from their homes and the food banks were overflowing with people who had been previous donors and now needed to be recipients. What a scary time. And I really, I felt a part of that. I was a part of that because I had been laid off and, you know, I was sort of like, I just don't know what I'm going to do.
Right.
So I wrote the book that I needed to read.
You write at one point, being in this recession feels like watching a nature film about the disintegration of a major polar ice shelf. Huge chunks of everything we thought was solid keep breaking apart and disappearing into an abyss, the depth of which no one knows. We're speaking with Suzanne Colon about her book, Cherries in Winter, My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. I think one thing that helps us appreciate the shock and sadness that you experienced when you were laid off from your job with the magazine is that you describe how much you loved your job. And you're very honest even about how much not only did you love the actual work, but some of the trappings that were also a part of that. You said, I loved that job and everything that went with it. Describe a little further what I'm talking about and what all you lost the day you were laid off.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have always been very aware of the fact that I worked in a very glamorous industry. And I've always been extremely grateful for that. I don't think that there's a day that I have taken it for granted. You know, some people might say, oh, gee, too bad, you know, she lost her job at a magazine. But the fact of the matter is, it's not really about that as much as just the loss of the job. You know, I might as well have been a bartender, which I have been in the past during one of our previous recessions. I could have been a day trader. I could have been a maid. I could have been anything. But this job in particular, as I think anybody who works in an office that they really like, you know, a lot of people get laid off from jobs that they didn't like to begin with. And so in some cases, there's a sense of relief. This job, yes, as you said, not only did I love the work, the quality of the work that I was doing, the kind of work, but also, I mean, people used to say to me, oh, my goodness, you work in that building? Yes, I do. You know, sometimes where you work and what you do informs other people's opinions about you. You know, I was somebody, capital S, because I worked in that building, which was such a glamorous and wonderful place to work. And we had a lovely cafeteria that served sushi and things like that. And so that led to, well, when I get laid off from that job, what does that say about me? Does that inform people's opinions about me in a different way? Suddenly, you know, I'm just me living in New Jersey and doing what exactly? You know, I think that this is something that a lot of people go through when they lose their job, which is a loss of identity. You know, if I'm not, you know, fill in the blank previous title, what am I? Who am I?
By the way, I think it's kind of interesting that you never tell us what magazine laid you off. I assume that's a conscious decision on your part. Do you mind if I ask why you felt like keeping that information from us?
Well, it's not so much that I was keeping it from anybody as I was not dwelling on the type of job that I had. Because as I say, you know, it was not about what I was doing, but that I was no longer doing it. And in order to make this, this is one of the times where I was thinking about the reader. You know, there's not a lot of people across the country who are working in magazines. You know, there are a rich, wide variety of jobs that people have lost in this recession. And it was more me focusing on the very universal feelings that we all have when we get laid off, which is, oh, my goodness, now what? You know, there's this fear that comes up, a fear of the unknown. What next? What will I do? Healthcare, all the stuff. You know, how am I going to make the rent? And that was more the point. It's not about what I was doing. I mean, because, I mean, there are some people in life who, when they get laid off, their salaries have been so high that it's really kind of hard to worry about them. You know, gee, I'm sorry you lost your seven-figure income, and I hope you put a large part of that away. And then there are other people for whom, you know, I know a lot of people, some members of my family, who are living paycheck to paycheck and just barely making it. A loss of a job is a devastating, catastrophic blow. That is more what I was focusing on. I did not want people to get sidetracked by, oh, she worked at that place. You know, that was not really the important part.
Right. That makes perfect sense. I think that was then a good choice. One thing you do say about your life as a writer, and I think this is worth mentioning, it helps us bring your Nana into the picture, is that it's one of the things that you happen to share with her, a love of words. And you say that you have learned since that your grandmother dearly wanted to remain in school and go to college and perhaps become a writer, and never would be able to do that. You said, "I've always loved what I do, but now I approach even a small assignment with a large amount of gratitude because you think about your grandmother and her own love of words." Describe that in a little greater detail, your grandmother and her love of words.
Well, my Nana had an experience when she was very young. She had a second grade teacher whose name was Miss Bumstead, actually, which I thought was very charming. That was not changed. And Miss Bumstead took my Nana, who grew up in a dirt poor neighborhood in the Bronx, tenements, lots of other immigrant kids, with the tenement departments overflowing with relatives and things like that. So she had no idea that she was poor. And Miss Bumstead invited her over for tea one day after school because they lived in the same sort of, general neighborhood, but Miss Bumstead lived a couple blocks over in the what they used to call the lace curtain Irish area, where the doctors and the lawyers lived, the more well-to-do people. And so my Nana goes over, my Nana-to-be, this is little Matilda, second grade, goes over to her teacher's home and sees that it is absolutely beautiful brownstone. There's a maid serving them tea and cookies on a silver tray. Just like everything is lovely. There are shelves and shelves of books, and it's very beautiful. And so she decides that she would like to be a teacher like Miss Bumstead. She's going to go to school and do really well. So she did. She excelled all through school, except for the fact that, as I mentioned, being from a relatively constantly broke family, she was taken out of school at the age of 16 to go to work because, as she wrote in these papers that I later found when I was looking for her recipes, in her family, school was something that was to be completed to the extent of the law. In other words, the mandatory amount of school only. But the idea of one of these kids going on to college was just never entertained. There was no money, and it was not something that was done in my family. So she was taken out of school at 16. She was, somebody obtained a job for her as a secretary, a family member with a connection, and off she went to be a secretary. And she never lost that desire to write. She never lost that love of words. She used to read dictionaries and get new editions of dictionaries the way some people get books. She loved to write. She did not keep a diary so much as write magazine essays and book chapters. And these things would never be sent off. I don't know if she was scared or I think she got one rejection letter for a children's book that she wrote, and that was kind of it. But she never stopped writing. And I never realized until I read these papers how much she wanted to be a writer, how she would have loved to have written a book or even gotten one magazine essay published. And here I am doing this, it was astounding to me. And I felt really good about being able to put one of her poems in the book, so she finally did get published, albeit posthumously. Still, it was a revelation to me, and there was a lot of weeping that day.
I bet. So tell us a little more about what you've just very briefly touched on, that is how the news of your layoff from the magazine, among other things, sent you either down to the basement or up to the attic, I don't remember where, but maybe both,
the basement.
In search of a trunk where you were going to find something that you really needed to hold in your hands. Tell us what you were so feverishly searching for.
Well, I was looking for my Nana's recipe file. Now, this was something that my Nana started compiling, I don't even know when, probably during, I would say, shortly before World War II or even before that. And it was given to my mother, and my mother gave it to me, and it was just something that I, you know, I knew about but had never really made use of because prior to this recession, I've never been much of a cook. I'm not exactly handy in the kitchen. I, like my Nana, my Nana was a career girl. She, as I mentioned, went to work starting at the age of 16, and I went to work, pretty much around when I was 21. So we never really learned that much about cooking. So when I got laid off, and I'm sure everybody experiences this, suddenly everything seems very expensive, rent, mortgage, food. And I was talking with my mother one day about how, you know, I could no longer do the things that I used to do without thinking, which was buy prepared foods, get takeout, things like that. It was just too expensive on an unemployment check. So she suggested that I go find Nana's recipe file because she said there will be a lot of recipes in there from times like this where money was scarce, sometimes food was scarce, such as World War II, Great Depression, etc. She said, find the recipe file because there will be instructions in there for good, simple, sturdy food. So I went tearing down to the basement, and I find this. I go searching through the trunk. I had no idea where this thing was. I just knew that it was down there somewhere. And I found this fraying, brown, dusty folder with a treasure trove of my Nana's recipes in there, and also these little booklets that she used to send away for. People used to send like two box tops or something to get a booklet of recipes from a food company. So I found those in there, and those were really fabulous. But I found my Nana's notes on the recipes. I found her writing in a separate box nearby. And all of a sudden, it was sort of like receiving this very reassuring hug from her, because here was evidence that she had gotten through times much more challenging than what I was going through and had come out of it not only surviving, but had been thriving, actually. Good news.
Absolutely. Good news. You write this, Nana died when I was 7, and my grandpa, who could put up a mean stoop, a thick, chunky soup, when I was only 13. I was too young to remember their wisdom or to have understood it in the first place. But I have the file. The recipes Nana wrote and saved offered more than directions for making the comfort food that sustained my family for 4 generations. They are artifacts from times both good and bad, not vague references, but proof that we've been through worse than this and have come out okay. And right now, that's something I need to know. Beyond that really emotional value to what you found and the tangible value of having these recipes that you wanted to utilize, you also mentioned that these recipes represent sort of a timeline of America's eating patterns. Explain that a little further, what we learn about how Americans have eaten through the generations just by sort of proceeding through these recipes of your grandmother's in chronological fashion.
Yes, it was very interesting to see that because the file was not in order. I mean, this is kind of a, you know, pages stuffed in an old file kind of thing. They were not set in any kind of order or index or anything like that. So I tried to put them in some semblance of order as much as I could, being that most of them weren't dated, but they didn't really need to be because I could tell first from the look of the paper, which is, you know, very old, yellowing, maybe a little less old, maybe a little less yellow as we get more recent. But I was looking at, for example, there was a recipe for German potato salad, which came from my great-great-grandmother. Now, potatoes, I found out from my mother, were just a staple in the house because they were cheap. You know, my great-great-grandfather was a stonemason, and work was sporadic at best. And so there were times where they would have mashed potatoes and coffee for dinner for about a week until his wages came through or he began working again. Then I started finding the World War II era recipes, and I could tell which those were because there were all these substitutions. You know, butter, not available. So they would say, you know, use lard, use, you know, the whatever substitutions were available, the margarine, the Crisco, that sort of thing. And they didn't have wheat flour, so they would say use soya flour. And all of these other, you know, there might not be sugar available, so they would have substitutions for that. And I noticed that there were a great deal of chicken recipes because at this point during World War II, my grandparents and my mother, who was a child then, were living on a farm in upstate New York, and they raised chickens. They raised their own chickens, which is something that's coming back right now as people are trying to economize and also, you know, as a bit of a rebellion against the way food is processed in this country right now, which is pretty deplorable. But then after the war, I see these recipes for, you know, recreate the dishes you ate in Europe at home. And this is when post-war people were doing two things. One is that they were accommodating soldiers returning from Europe who had grown accustomed to things like lasagna, which, you know, only Italian families knew about beforehand here, and also when it was considered a very fashionable trip to take. Oh, we're touring Europe. You know, this is around 1958 or something like that. This was just a very, you know, a de rigueur thing to do. So I could tell a lot about where our country had been through the food that we either had, didn't have, or were trying to emulate at any given time.
We're speaking with Suzanne Colon about her book, Cherries in Winter, My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. You learned a lot about your grandmother's life and some of its difficulty. And, of course, we've spoken primarily about the difficulty she and her generation experienced in living through the Great Depression. But actually, your grandmother's difficulties started long before that. And among the heaviest burdens which she was bearing as a youngster was the fact that her father, in your words, was a drunkard who wanted nothing to do with her. And yet somehow...
Those were her words.
Well, those are her words. Interesting.
Her words, yes. That's the way she described him in her writings. Yeah. Hmm.
And yet you go on to write, she thrived somehow in the soil in which she was planted. So aside from this father who seemed to do no good for her whatsoever, there were others that formed healthy soil in which she could somehow flourish. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. It was really lovely to hear as a balance for this this father who, you know, I mean, my Nana was born an illegitimate child. And at first, the father said, you know, he was brought to the hospital by my great-grandmother's brothers, who were absolutely outraged that he did not want to marry her. And they showed him the baby, and he said, well, you know, that's not my kid. And this was really just so distressing. But my great-grandfather was so angry with him that he almost didn't want my great-grandmother to marry, you know, this cad. At any rate, the rest of the family was extremely loving. And my great-great-grandfather in particular was just absolutely adoring of this child who would be my Nana. Matilda was her name. And he doted on her. He absolutely doted on her. And he taught her how to read from a very early age. She was very clever early on. She used to meet him at the subway station every day, and they would walk home together. And, you know, he'd stop. Back then, they had beer pails. You know, you didn't buy beer in bottles. You bought it in a pail. And so they'd stop by the tavern, and he'd get his beer pail filled and let her carry it home. And he taught her how to swing it around over her head very quickly so that not a drop would be lost. And there were always a lot of relatives around because, of course, you know, this is the early 1900s. immigrant families lived in one apartment, many, many relatives, and they all took care of her. There were a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins and, you know, all of these relatives very, very focused on her. Plus, you know, the neighborhood kids all in the same boat. So they were very, very tight group. And this very nurturing teacher she had in the second grade, Miss Bumstead, there was a lot of love in the family that counteracted this rejection that she had from her biological father. So, you know, she really did thrive. She had no idea that she was poor. She had no idea that she was illegitimate until much later. And her family loved her so much that she wouldn't have cared until, you know, of course, she was an adult and understood the implications of these events.
Tell us about the man she ultimately married.
My grandpa, Charlie. He was just the most charismatic type of person. I mean, he lied to get into World War One. I believe he was 15 or 16 at the time. His older brother, George, was going, and he decided that he was going to sign up, too, very courageously. And you know, I mean, having no idea what he was getting into, as a lot of young men, a lot of patriotic young men in that era had no idea what they were going to be facing. And he was shipped off to Europe, where he was promptly gassed and shot at and involved in a whole bunch of skirmishes, just absolutely terrifying. He had to help amputate one of his buddy's legs on the field. I mean, it was just really horrific. And then he came home, and his girlfriend promptly became pregnant, and he was married at the age of 17, had two children, and his wife died of influenza. And he was very resourceful. His stepmother taught him a great deal about cooking and managing a household, because she figured that this was something that every man should know. And it would prove to be very helpful later on, because without a mother to take care of them, the children, his children, were sent to live with relatives. And he went to work at a dairy as a milkman, and just, he was very independent, resourceful, self-sufficient. During the Depression, he stayed on working as a milkman, and he was apparently known as the heartbreaker of Sheffield Farms, because he was very popular with the ladies. He was a handsome Irishman. And he, to me, was just, you know, he was my substitute father. And later on in life, when I was a child, my grandparents lived very near an inlet of Long Island Sound. And my grandpa would go out and catch bluefish, and he'd see the water churning, and he would run downstairs and grab his fishing rod and cast the line in. Didn't even have to bait the hook, because bluefish, when they're in a feeding frenzy, they'll just chomp down on anything. So he's hauling these huge flapping bluefish out, and they've got all these teeth, and I'm, you know, screaming my head off. And he would get out a few and gut them and clean them and broil them. And this was dinner. You know, this was how we had dinner. And later on in life, I would term him the Ernest Hemingway of the Bronx, because I just found him to be this very, you know, masculine, charismatic character. He's this big barrel-chested guy, and he took care of me just so well. And in an uncertain world, he was somebody I could really count on.
This is how you describe it at one point. For a child being raised by a young woman who was herself still growing up, and with both of us going through a dark period of mourning for Nana, Grandpa was pure security, a strong substitute father who doted on me and could literally catch dinner in our backyard. As long as I was with him, I thought, nothing in this unpredictable world could hurt me.
Yes.
One of the things which changes your Nana's life profoundly, and in a sense changes profoundly her relationship with the world of food, is, as you described, the day her husband Charlie comes home and says, "Tilly, I've bought a farm."
Oh, goodness. I can't even imagine what she must have thought that afternoon. You know, my Nana had wanted to go finish high school and go to college. And as I mentioned, she was taken out of school by her family and set to work. But she did enjoy working, ultimately. She liked being a career girl. This was a time when most women, if they were working at all, were working, you know, until they got married and found a husband and, you know, became a family person. But my Nana was very self-sufficient. You know, after the Depression, she kept working. She had her own money. She was a great contributor to the family. She was the only contributor to the family during the Depression. But she, you know, this there was some cachet there. You know, she was self-sufficient.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
My grandpa very impulsively went out and bought 500 chicks and a bunch of horses and dairy cows and a herding dog who couldn't actually herd anything. And my Nana, the career girl who had never really learned how to cook, finds herself confronted with a house that is so old it's crumbling. I think it had been built during the Revolutionary War. And the kitchen was a wall hearth with different compartments for baking, warming, cooking, you know, with the pot hanging off the hook type of thing. And she just did not know what to do. She was absolutely flummoxed by this thing. So that winter wasn't so great for them, except in one sense, which was that their neighbors asked them if they'd like to join the Grange. And the Grange is an association of farmers that is in existence to this day. It's well over 100 years old. And my grandpa went to go talk to the men, and Nana was brought into the women's area, and they were having a recipe exchange that night. And all of the women were saying, well, I've got this recipe for this, and I've got this recipe for that. And they said, Matilda, you know, do you have anything to contribute? Now, my grandmother was fresh from the city, and, you know, going to an office, she made sure she had her makeup on every day, she did her hair, she did her nails, all of that. And so she carried this with her to the farm, where she's very much out of place. She has no recipes. She's really a little nervous about this. And so she comes up with an idea, and she says to them, I'll make a deal with you. If you ladies teach me how to cook and bake and can fruit and vegetables, I will come to your homes and do your hair and makeup. What do you say? And the ladies of the Grange were absolutely thrilled with this bargain, and there it began. You know, they would dictate their recipes to her, which is why a lot of the recipes are typewritten. Because my Nana was a very meticulous typist, and she would do their hair and makeup. So my Nana learned how to cook, and the Grange ladies looked a little prettier that winter.
You tell us that the hard work that, of course, is part of living on a farm was not a problem for your grandmother. What was harder was the isolation.
Yes, yes, absolutely. This was a woman who had lived either at home or in the Bronx, very close to home, and all of her relatives for all of her life until now. And then all of a sudden she's taken from the Bronx to Saratoga, which is, you know, a couple of hours travel. Now, remember that this is a time, you know, this is during World War II, when maybe not everybody has a car. You know, it's not as easy as it is for us now. Back then, it was not that easy to make. It was a big trip, you know, and everybody in the family had families of their own. So she would go for long periods of time without seeing anybody. Plus, you know, we were able to get on the phone today without really much of a thought of it. And back then, they didn't even have a phone at first at the farm. So we're talking about letters and maybe, you know, an annual visit or something like that. And come the winter time, the winters in Saratoga were such that it was not unusual to find 5 feet of snow in front of the door one day. And occasionally there would be days and days that would go by without seeing anybody except for the mailman if he could get through. So, you know, joining the Grange was a good thing for them, but they didn't have a lot of close ties in Saratoga. They made friends with their neighbors, but the closest neighbor was at least a mile down the road. So the isolation that my Nana felt, you know, she went from being surrounded by these loving family members to having basically my mom as a child during the day, and if she went to school, not even that. It must have been crushingly lonely for her, really, now that I think of it.
And at one point, she finally takes matters into her own hands, and your grandfather comes home one day and discovers all the cows and chickens are gone.
Absolutely gone. Everything. The horses, even the dog had been given to a neighbor. He came home one day. He worked the night shift at a local plant, and so it was his practice to come home, milk the cows, put out the canisters for the dairyman to come and pick up, and go to bed. Maybe have a meal and then go to bed. And he comes home ready to milk the cows. There's no cows. Goes running into the chicken coop. There's no chickens. He comes into the house and says, "Tilly, what happened? Where are all the animals?" And she says very calmly, "I have sold them all, and we're going to Florida because I cannot take another winter here. If we don't go, I don't know what's going to happen." Now, you have to understand that my grandpa, his word was absolutely law. He was the boss of the house, very kind of, you know, boisterous person. But he looked at her and heard the tone in her voice and saw the look on her face, and he basically said, "Okay." He could not argue with her because I think she just popped a cork one day and she had had it with Sarah. And they left. They went down to Florida. They got in a Model A Ford that was falling apart, had faulty brakes and no roof to speak of. And they drove down to Florida with the $100 that Nana had gotten for the sale of the animals on the farm.
And what's so interesting is that you give us at least some excerpts from the meticulous records that your grandmother kept about that trip and the expenses which they incurred. Gas and oil, $2.91. Candy, 30 cents. Lunch at so-and-so. Expense, $1.90. Left at 1:30. Stopped at Poughkeepsie at 3:30. Cake, 70 cents. Oil, 50 cents. And so on. On it goes until finally, at last, they are able to reach Florida and enjoy something of a new experience there. But, I mean, what a leap of faith. To take a trip like that, knowing no one, with scarcely any money in their pockets. In some ways, this really nicely takes us into one of the lessons that your grandmother had learned, which your mother learned and you yourself have learned, which kind of connects us with the title of the book, Cherries in Winter. The idea that sometimes, even when we have very little in the way of money, there is something to be gained by reaching for that thing which you really maybe cannot quite afford, or that practicality might suggest you skip. That in some instances it makes all the difference in the world to experience cherries in winter. I think actually the first instance of that involved some decorative vases.
Yes. In a story that very closely mirrors the kind of credit card crisis that we have gone through very recently in our nation's history, my great-great-grandmother was given an allotment of money of my great-great-grandfather's stonemason wages to get food for the week. And we're not talking extravagant food either. But she passed by a shop one day and saw these vases that were so just alluring, captivating, that she found herself going into the shop. And then she finds herself asking about the vases. And then she finds herself holding the vases. And you know the rest of the story is that she spends the week's food money on these vases. My great-great-grandfather, Peter, comes home. No food is cooking. She is mashing apples and is cutting bread. And he asks, "If this, what is for dinner?" She says, "This." And she tells him the story, and he erupts, as he, you know, you would imagine somebody would. "Bread and applesauce for dinner, you know, are you crazy? Why did you do this?" And she says, "Because we will have these vases for long after our stomachs will be filled again. You know, we will eat again, but we will have these vases forever." And in a sense, she was right, because for a week's worth of hardship, my great-grandmother was given those vases. She, in turn, gave them to my grandmother. My grandmother gave them to my mother. And I have grown up around those vases, knowing that they were a family heirloom, but not knowing the story behind them. So, you know, we have these vases that my great-great-grandmother just, you know, she had to have them. But this was, remember, this was probably a woman who owned one dress, you know, who bought food and nothing more. She probably did not have jewelry or anything like that. This was her one lifetime extravagance. She can be forgiven for that, I think. And then on a much, much lesser scale in the same vein is the story behind the title of the book, Cherries in Winter, which is that when my Nana was working at a convention center called the Coliseum, which used to be in New York in the late 50s and early 60s, now the Time Warner Center, there was a shop around the corner that sold fancy fruit and good candy and things like that. And she would take my mother to the store and buy a little handful of winter bing cherries. Now, this was something that was very unusual. Today, we have fruit that's out of season year-round because it's shipped from all over the world. So it's not that exciting to us today to have a mango in January or something like that. But back then, it was kind of a big deal to find out-of-season fruit. It was expensive. And my Nana, if she was having a hard day or a hard week, would just go and buy a little handful of this luxury, and they would go to Central Park. And my mom remembers my Nana saying, "Is there anything better than sitting in Central Park in the middle of New York eating cherries in the wintertime?"
And you write, "Nana's winter cherries were not expensive as the vases, but they meant the same thing. She spent a little more to keep herself from feeling like less." This is probably one of the ways in which your Nana was able to build the life that she did and was able to say this about her life: "We may have been broke, but we were never poor." And gradually, you have come to understand that about her and about your mother and even about your own life.
Absolutely. This is something that I remember Nana saying quite a bit, and I never really understood it until recently. What she meant was, you know, there were plenty of times that my relatives from previous generations could have qualified as being poor. But to them, it was much better to say, "We're broke," because that implied that this was a temporary situation, that better times would be coming. And so this was something that they said to keep from having the poverty of the soul. It was a numbing feeling of, all right, we're poor. We're never going to get out of this, this downtrodden feeling that would stoop one over and turn the corners of the mouth down irreparably. To say, "Oh, well, you know, we're broke," there was a little hope in there. There was a little idea of, you know, we'll get through this. We'll, you know, better times are coming.
And of course, that's one of the most important lessons for all of us, even in the midst of whatever kind of winter we might be experiencing. This memoir, again, is called Cherries in Winter: My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. It's published by Doubleday. It does include not only all of these wonderful stories and more, but also many of the actual recipes mentioned. And we even see facsimile photos of the recipes themselves as they appear in that precious recipe file. The book is published by Doubleday. Suzanne Colon, the author. Suzanne Colon, I have so enjoyed your book and this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure it's been speaking with you, and happy holidays.